Ladies and gentlemen. Okay, we... Steve is coming back. Good evening, I'm Bob Lewis. As chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, it's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight to this panel. And in doing so, I want to thank BMO Financial Group, the sponsor of this series of talks, this being the last in our winter and spring series. And I also want to thank CNW for helping us with our communications needs so generously. I also invite you to consider coming to the June 13th Awards Gala, if you haven't signed up. I mean, it's our premier evening to honor good journalism in this country. And we always get a good crowd, so if you're so inclined, there are still some seats available. And we'd welcome you if you can make it. I also want to say that the board of CJF has recently agreed to continue being an important sponsor of the Canadian Journalism Project. That is to say, the two websites that we run in conjunction with the journalism schools and other organizations in Canada, namely JSource and Projet J in Montreal. So we're very proud of that longstanding operation, which frankly is the only place where you can really get ongoing diet of journalism news and analysis. So now I want to introduce our moderator, Bruce Dobigan. He's a broadcaster, a columnist, a writer, an anchor, a playwright, a TV producer. He's a two-time Gemini winner, noted for his groundbreaking investigative work into the Allan Eagleson case and the NHL Pension Fund. He began his broadcasting career with CBC Radio in 1984 as a local sports anchor. He then moved on to CBC TV as a sports anchor for the evening and nightly news shows. Later at Newsworld, he created and hosted a series of popular sports programs. He also anchored CBC Newsworld's coverage of the 1996 Atlanta Summer Games. And in 1998, he was the anchor for the CBC Radio coverage of the Winter Olympics from Nagano. More recently, he's co-hosted a daily radio show here in Toronto on the Fan 590. I guess it's now called the Fan 590 Sportsnet. Or Sportsnet Fan 590, or 590 Sportsnet The Fan. He then moved on to the Fan 960 in Calgary. He's been a columnist with the Herald, and until recently, I don't know if it was Don Cherry's Lance or Freelance Cutbacks, he was the popular and influential sports media columnist for the Globe and Mail. He's the author of five books, with one on the way. His new book, Best Practices, The Vancouver Canucks and the Pursuit of Excellence, is due out in the fall of 2013. I don't know, Bruce, if you're going to change the title or add a chapter, but we're looking forward to it.
Great timing.
He's also an avid gardener, wine collector, and I can tell you on great authority, a decent golfer. So let me give you the talented and eclectic Bruce Dobigan.
Thanks, everyone, and thank you for coming down and for the coming to see us and the discussion. I know if the phone call that we had earlier this week where we talked about what we're going to talk about tonight is any indication of what we're going to do tonight, I think you'll have a really interesting and edifying time here. This is all happening, of course, at a really pivotal time in terms of sports journalism, in terms of journalism itself. The technologies have changed everything in the last 5 years, how we do our jobs, et cetera. And part of what we're going to do tonight is talk about that and then talk a little bit about whether we can continue to do those jobs going forward. But I think, first of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't get to the other panelists on the panel tonight, and I'll start to my immediate right. Steve Mace is the publisher and editor-in-chief of Sportsnet magazine. That's Canada's only sports-only magazine. Prior to launching Sportsnet, he served as the editor and publisher of Canadian Business magazine. Before that, as the executive editor and national business columnist for Maclean's. He has also served as a reporter, editor, and columnist with the National Post, the Bloomberg News, and the Halifax Chronicle-Herald. He co-wrote the 2009 book, The Ego Boom, and is a three-time National Magazine Award winner for his writing. Steve Mace.
Thank you very much.
Carly Agro joined CBC Sports in 2012 as a host and a reporter. She brings a background in sports broadcasting as well as having played high-level amateur sports, having played soccer in the NCAA. She's worked for the Hamilton Tiger Cats organization as host of Ty Cats TV. She was in Lloydminster, Alberta. I'm not going to say the Saskatchewan part. As an Alberta guy these days, I always go with the Alberta part. She was a sports anchor and reporter there, and at CTV Edmonton, she was a sports reporter and anchor as well. Carly Agro.
You can add my golfing in there too if you want.
How is your golfing?
I might have to prove I'm a decent golfer one of these days.
Well, if you're a member at Hamilton, you can take me anytime. I'll be happy to. This is like a Monty Python sketch with all the Bruces up here. But anyhow, Bruce Kidd is the warden of Hardhouse, a professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology and Physical Education at the U of T, former dean of the faculty. He teaches and has written extensively about the history and political economy of Canadian and international sport and physical activity. Most recent book, co-edited with Heather Dichter, is Olympic Reform 10 Years Later. He's worked with local, national, and international bodies to bring advanced opportunities in sports and physical education, and he was one hell of a runner, too. Bruce? I'm old enough to remember that stuff, Bruce. That's the problem. Some people just think you're an academic. Anyhow, where I'd like to start tonight to try to get the discussion going, as I said, is I'd like to talk a little bit about how our job has changed. Before we can talk about are we doing our job properly, I think we all have to acknowledge how the job has changed because of technology in the past 5 to 10 years. And I'd like to sort of take it right through our panelists and just talk to them a little bit about how the technological changes have affected them. And Steve, I mean, what has been the biggest impact for you in terms of technological change?
Well, for us, I think what people are looking to print media for has changed an awful lot. I mean, if you go back just 10 or 15 years ago, people were looking to the morning newspaper in many cases to tell you who won the game last night. Right. By the time somebody's picking up a print product today, they know who won the game. They know what the stats are. The advent of the web has accelerated the news cycle enormously across the entire range of topics, but sports is first and foremost. So at the magazine, at Sportsnet, we talk an awful lot about the fact that we're not in the business of news at all, really. We are not telling people who won the game, what the standings are, what the stats are. We're in the business of trying to tell deep stories, provide context for the games, introduce people to the characters and to the personalities that they care so much about. It's raised a whole new level of challenge, I think, for print journalists in particular. And, you know, the other things that have happened, of course, is that we've seen the players get more distant from the media. We can talk an awful lot about that. It's much, much more difficult now to get access to the teams and to add value in a way that I think was easier 15 years ago.
When you're sitting in your story meetings and you know you're doing a bi-weekly magazine, how do you account, though, for that, the reality which of Twitter and social media, which says that news is only like 30 seconds old? How do you deal with that?
Well, I think because what has happened is everybody is focused on minute-by-minute updates and increasingly minute changes, you know what I mean? The rumor mill is an incredibly important driver of news. What has been abandoned to a certain extent are those deep, long stories that provide context and provide deeper storytelling. And all the sports fans that I know, they love that stuff. They're dying for it. And in fact, as the amount of media has proliferated, it's all kind of concentrated in that, what I call kind of fast twitch news.
Yep.
And we've moved away from the slower, longer term trend stories, getting at the things that I would argue are actually the things that really inflame people's passion about sports. Mm. You know, it's not really the trades or the stats or the latest rumor that really makes people emotionally invested in sports. It's the personalities, it's the values that tend to be imbued in the game when the game is at its best. And by aiming at that, we've managed to kind of colonize this area of the news agenda that other people have walked away from.
Carly, you do morning television. People are waking up to you. On the other hand, as Steve just said, they know the score from the night before. They know the highlights. They've seen it all. How is the new technology changing the way you deliver your sports in the morning?
Well, I think the most notable difference is what happens from the final whistle to when I'm on at 6 in the morning showing the highlights is there's a whole lot of reaction that takes place online in these social media sites. And oftentimes, you know, when I first started in journalism, I was always told, be a good storyteller, be a good storyteller. That's the most important thing. Tell a good story. And I still think that that's true, but I think what the social media sites and all this input that any and everyone is able to have, oftentimes what happens now is that the reaction can become the story. And you have to be very careful that you're not taking away from what the story should be. And that becomes a really difficult thing to do because we're doing morning television. The goal of morning television, anyone will tell you, is to talk about what people are talking about because you want to give them what they need to have that conversation at the water cooler with whoever that may be. And, you know, I can think of the perfect example this week would be the Tiger Woods Sergio Garcia story. And this was a story that took place on Twitter, because Tiger Woods didn't give his reaction to Sergio Garcia's comments to a television camera, to a print reporter, on the radio. He didn't pick up the phone.
So how did you do that?
That was the challenge this week. And television is supposed to be about good pictures, about good sounds, and we didn't have any of that. And we are a national broadcaster, and we are the CBC, and here we are showing Twitter boards. Twitter boards is our lead story in sports. And that has become, you still have an obligation to tell the story, but how do you do that? Well, we've got a Twitter board, folks, and this is our story for the day. And yes, fortunately, Sergio Garcia happened to be teeing off, and he had a golf tournament to play. So we had Sergio Garcia's apology. We had a moving, talking human head. But that's become a real challenge, is what is the story? Is it the reaction? Or is it something else? And I think that that's a really notable, something that we deal with literally on a daily basis. We have Daniel Alfredson's comments.
I was going to say Daniel Alfredson, that's a perfect
example. Last night after the game. And this was interesting because I watched SportsCenter first thing in the morning and they did not have the clip on TSN this morning. TSN had to air a board, which is a graphic on your television screen that says what Daniel Alfredson said. Thank goodness somebody from CBC and Hockey Night in Canada stuck around and kept their microphone in the scrum last night and happened to catch Daniel Alfredson saying his second part of that clip, which was, yeah, you know, we're in real tough with their depth. I don't know. Probably not. We can't come back. Yeah. But what a difference that makes in your ability to tell the story is, you know, I've been in post games. I'm sure you guys have before. You know how tight for time you are. You get your money clip and you're out of there because you know you're only going to air 15 seconds at the most of what Daniel Alfredson has to say. But last night it was a perfect example of what a difference 45, 50 seconds can make of you sticking around. The difference between having to run that board or having the ability to actually show Daniel Alfredson talking and speaking and saying that.
Now, Bruce, when you were an athlete, someone could take a quote from you and print it a week later, and it was still considered news. It was hot news. You have a perspective over the course of your career as both a participant and as an observer and as an academic, et cetera. How are you viewing the changes that have happened in the last 5 years to sports journalism and how it affects those causes that you're particularly partial to?
Well, I accept that it's really complicated the lives of journalists. And as we've heard, made your lives much more difficult. I think the new social media have also enabled many more voices to comment on sport, and I think that's been a plus. But from the overarching perspective of the last 40 years, I would say that there's been very little change in the way that sport is portrayed by the mass media. If there's been any change, there's been a narrowing of what the mass media covers. Most Canadians get their information about sport from the mass media, and I would say that image, that portrayal, that landscape is completely distorted from the reality of how Canadians participate in sport in the way that my colleagues and I study. It's focused. It's very hard to generalize about the mass media as a whole because there are so many different outlets. There are cities with a lot of competition, like Toronto, and others with not very much. But let me toss this generalization out there. the mass media do not cover Canadian sport. They cover the commercial or capitalist, masculinist, continental sector, with few exceptions. It is essentially the boys' page or the boys' show, despite the remarkable increase in participation by girls and women over the last 40 years. The amount of coverage of those efforts is not much better than it was when I was running 40 and 50 years ago. If you look at the papers, if you look at the shows, what is covered is the continentalist cartels, the NHL, the NBA, Major League Baseball. The CFL is an exception to that, Major League Soccer. And that's about it, with very few exceptions, very few exceptions. And that hasn't changed. If anything, the increasing large concentration of ownerships have narrowed that even more. And there's a huge commercial conflict of interest in this coverage, so that even the best reporters are constrained by those economic interests to cover what their corporations are contractually involved in. And even in print, which is not contractually involved, it invariably is, are we the media sponsor of an event, and therefore we'll cover it? And if we're not the media sponsor event, we won't cover it. And so the public landscape of Canadian sport has shrunk to where most of what we hear is about the NHL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, Major League Soccer, and a few others, except for the Olympics, which is only every other year. So despite these amazing changes, I don't think that there has been very much change in the way the landscape of Canadian sport is portrayed.
If I read you right, you're saying it's even more concentrated than it ever was, that in fact the proliferation of the new media has made it even more intense, where people in the United States, it's only the NFL and maybe some college sports. In Canada, it's only the NHL. Are you suggesting that it's accelerated that process?
It's accelerated that process, and I had one person tell me tonight that if there's not a media sponsor an event, Enterprise would not cover that. If I've misheard, he can correct me. At one of the meetings that you and I attended not so long ago, Bruce, one of our very best Canadian sports writers told us that it's rare now that he doesn't cover anything that's not contractually connected to the vast corporation that he works for.
Okay, Steve, you work for Rogers.
Yep. That's,
I think he's hinting at one of the stories, and I got some pushback for writing this, is Rogers' promotion of the Blue Jays. Mm-hmm. Is this a positive thing for journalism, or is this a negative thing for journalism, where Rogers, the company you work for, owns so much and has properties that they're promoting?
Well, let me just attack it in two different parts. I'll get back to the Blue Jays and the ownership issue to begin with, but I think that there's a bit of a chicken and an egg issue here that Bruce is pointing to, because we are all commercial media organizations, and unfortunately, what we're fortunately or unfortunately, the truth of the matter is we're in the business of selling audiences.
Right.
So we go where the eyeballs are, where the interests are. So it's not a matter, I can tell you, on the editorial level of Sportsnet magazine or anywhere in Sportsnet, where people are coming down and saying, what we need to do is support the sports that we have an ownership interest in. Yeah. What we have to do is we need to go to the places where the interest is. Mm-hmm. And for better or for worse, that's top level professional sports. In Canada, that is NHL first and foremost, number one. That's when you do focus groups, polling, however you want to measure it, that is the 800-pound gorilla in terms of interest among Canadian sports fans. For us, according to our polling, baseball is number two. Then comes football. Interesting thing in Canada, when you ask people what do they mean by football, it's almost an even 50-50 split between CFL and NFL, and it's very, very regional. You go out west, CFL is king. In the eastern part of the country, it tends to be NFL, particularly in Ontario. And then it goes down from there, NBA, golf, tennis, that sort of thing. So our editorial decisions absolutely support those major leagues that Bruce is talking about, but it is about going to the places where we believe we can sell magazines, where the television network believes we will get people in front of their televisions, because we're relying on subscriber fees and advertising, all those things. So there is, it's a bit of a chicken and egg, self-fulfilling.
You used the chicken and egg analogy, and I'm sure, I don't want to speak for Bruce, but Bruce would say that maybe these people have been conditioned to want those
carefully
things.
Nurtured over probably the last 100 years.
Yeah.
Carefully
nurtured.
Not to put words in his mouth. Yeah.
Well,
Steve,
can
you speak to that?
Well, I can't take responsibility for the past 100 years, but I can speak for the past two. That
yes.
The reality of the matter is that that interest in sports is very, very concentrated. It's very, very concentrated in the pros. Mm-hmm. The pros are dominated by the men's sports. Bruce said that Olympics are an exception, and I think that they are. The interesting challenge for us as a media organization covering the Olympics is that when the Olympics are on, it's the only thing that matters in the whole wide world. And then is within 4 days of the Olympics ending, interest in the Olympics plunges. And in fact, I think that we actually have done a great deal of work trying to build the profile of Olympians in those intervening years.
Right.
And that coverage tends to be quite even-handed, I would say, between the men and the women. Mm-hmm. But as Bruce says, to me, the proof is in the fact that we have seen the proliferation over the past 5-10 years. It's easier than ever for people to go out there and make themselves amateur commentators on sports.
Right.
But if you look at the blogs, the blogs are concentrated on the professional sports as well. The blogs tend to be concentrated
right.
on where the interest is.
Yeah.
And if there was this great groundswell of public interest in the fringe sports and in the amateurs and that sort of thing, I think that would be reflected in the blogs because there is no barrier to entry.
No big call for javelin? Is that what you're saying?
There's not a really robust yes. female javelin blogging community.
Yes.
Sad as that may be.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we've discovered, and when we talk about technology, it's not just things like Twitter, it's not just the social media, it's also the evolution, of course, in terms of network coverage. And what we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years is that the only thing really propping up the traditional delivery methods of cable, satellite TV, and network TVs is professional sports.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only thing, that and news are about the only things you have to see live anymore. And so having properties, sports properties, has become so essential to networks. And Carly, I don't want to put you in the position mm-hmm. of speaking on behalf of CBC, but CBC is the broadcaster that has the NHL rights. They're coming up for negotiation in the next year. It's a huge thing for CBC and its credibility to keep the NHL rights. You also have to think when you're doing your stuff, though, you don't want to necessarily piss off the NHL, right?
Of course, but I think the interesting...
Use a sports phrase, by the way.
Yeah, I think I also come at this from a different angle because I consider myself a survivor of the lockout this year. And yes, it's no secret that CBC... I don't want to say survives, maybe I should use the word thrives, on the revenue that is generated from Hockey Night in Canada. Mm. That's a no-brainer. But I can also tell you that during the lockout, there were some really dark days at CBC. I work up on the sports floor, and we share that floor. It's the 8th floor. We share that floor with the Hockey Night in Canada staff. And if there's no hockey, for a lot of people, there's no work. And... I have to come at it from a different point of view, maybe a little bit different. You know, I'm not an editor of a magazine. I'm not, I work when there's work.
Right.
And there are a lot of my colleagues who were, quote, reassigned until further notice.
Mm-hmm.
And because there were no games to be responsible for the audio for,
right.
because there were no cameras to operate, because there were no features to produce, there was no work. So that makes things different, I think.
Well, let me ask, in my own experience, and Bob made reference to when I was doing the Allan Eagleson stories, I know that doing the Allan Eagleson stories effectively ended my career at Hockey Night in Canada before it ever got started.
Mm-hmm.
There was an unspoken rule that you just weren't supposed to do that. Again, get back to what you're talking about, what you're covering, and the things that you have to cover, and also how it affects the Hockey Night franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone ever talk to you? Does anyone ever sort of say, back off of that?
Truthfully, no. No one has ever come to me and said, mind your P's and Q's on this. Hey, let's make sure that we're not doing this. What I can tell you is that, yes, there is a conscious effort for promotion. So, for example, I anchor sports in the morning on News Network. If there is a game on Hockey Night in Canada that night, we have a promotion running at least once every hour. And I'm responsible for reading that promo board that comes up and says, hey, and you can catch Game 4 tonight on Hockey Night in Canada. So that is the trickle-down effect to someone like me. That's how that relationship with the NHL directly affects someone like me and their day-to-day tasks. So it is felt on every level. Would I rather get a voiceover in or an extra highlight pack in and show you Jose Bautista going 4-for-4? Because I can tell you I had to drop the Jays twice this morning and I wasn't happy about it just because of timing. But the reality is our Hockey Night in Canada promo board still got in.
Yeah.
So as far as how that affects me, that's how it affects the job I do on a day-to-day basis.
Bruce,
so is that journalism? Or is that something else? I mean, one of the classics.
Well, let me ask you something here, because you brought up the point. During those weeks of the Olympics, the corporate side is on side with the Olympics. The people in this country, as Steve said, people are interested, but the corporate side is interested. Why? And you want them to be interested 24/7, and we're not seeing that. Why is it that 2 weeks after the Olympics end, the corporate side leaves those people that they've sort of nurtured and that they've embraced for the last 2 weeks? Why is that, Bruce?
You know, I think the coverage of the Olympics is coming to resemble the coverage of the NHL in terms of the deliberate and the synergistic positioning of messages, where the way it's portrayed fits into a corporate mandate, and the big critical questions are, apart from, you know, whether the penalty in the qualifying match was justified or not, are really not covered, and the question is, I'm very conflicted about this. I think the journalists are better than ever before. I think they're better trained than ever before. I think that they have higher standards of ethics than ever before, but I see the constraints upon them much heavier and much more destructive than ever before. There's a classic study of sports journalism. Bruce McFarlane, another Bruce, master's thesis in sociology at McGill University, in 1955, when he looked at, he compared the occupational status of sports writers and public relations people with that of journalism, journalists. You know, their values, the way they work, what was important to them. And his purpose was to determine whether sports writers were journalists or public relations people. And he concluded that they were much more like public relations people than journalists. And he documented a time when sports writers were wholly embedded in the professional enterprises that they covered, that they lined up with the players for meal money. They took as much as a third or a half of their salary in kickbacks from the teams that covered, and they were bought to provide this flattering coverage. Since then, we've had the Guild, we've had professional journalism schools, we've had much greater changes, so that those kind of deliberate strategies of manipulation no longer work. But the culture is still very much the same, and you get these requirements that we just heard, where you've got to emphasize the programs that your network has these huge investments in. I haven't done any studies of this in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, though, I had students do a study of the way in which the CBC covered sports on television and the way that they covered it commercial-free on radio. And there were huge differences in the sports that were covered, in the extent of coverage of male and female activity, in the kind of questions that were asked, because there was no commercial imperative on CBC Radio.
And what happened to CBC Radio Sports? It's gone.
Well, now it's gone, and what you hear are promotions for the television casts in the evening.
Let me, again, Steve, you're here, you're the corporate guy, I guess. We're gonna, that's the hat you're wearing tonight.
Yay.
Respond to what Bruce is saying.
Well, I can only speak from my own experience, and I can tell you I do work for a big corporation, big media company. I work for a company that's got large investments in television rights, also got direct investments in sports teams, wholly owned the Toronto Blue Jays, own a big chunk of MLSE. I can tell you I've been doing this for a little more than 2 years, and I've never had anybody come to me and say, you need to cover this because we own the Jays. And you need to be nice to the Jays because we cover the Jays. It just has never happened. The limits, the constraints that I work under are resources. So I'm limited in terms of how many reporters I have, how much space I have, travel budget, that kind of thing, and the interests of our audience. Those are the two lines that I'm trying to bring together on a week-to-week basis. And you know, our tagline for our network, our five-platform media brand is fueled by fans, and I think it's actually a really good tagline. That actually is the mindset that imbues everything. What do the fans want? Where do they want us to be? What stories do they want us to tell? And one of the things that the fans are absolutely clear on is they expect integrity. They expect us to tell accurate, honest, fair-minded stories every single day to the best of our ability.
It's transparent to everybody who owns what and who does what. Just to a certain extent, that does that help? Because what Bruce is referring to, of course, is the old days where Conn Smythe would dole out meal money to people, etc. That was, the audience didn't know that. I think the audience, if it's sophisticated now, understands what it's
absolutely like. Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we talked about before is the fact that unfortunately, there has always been a certain conflict of interest in sports, and Bruce just very eloquently described what it was. Back in the day, reporters knew all kinds of stuff that they would never dream of reporting in a million years for all the reasons that Bruce just identified. Right. As recently as, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we had reporters who knew all kinds of stuff with the players and the teams and what was coming and what was going and who had this problem and who had that problem, never breathe a word of it.
Right.
Now, unfortunately, there's been a bit of a distance that's grown up between the teams and the players and media. You know, the access is much, much more controlled. The message track is much, much more controlled than it was. The players are trained from day one to distrust and, in many cases, disrespect the media. That has created a bit of, I would argue, a bit of an animosity between the two sides. The good side of that is exactly what you described. We're not in bed with each other anymore.
Right.
There is a lot more transparency, and there's a lot more, I would argue, tough reporting that goes on the games.
Carly,
but that's within a very, very small environment.
Right, where the commercial opportunity exists.
Right. Well, I mean,
because we are commercial businesses.
And,
you know, we might bemoan the fact that we are, but we are. We need to go where the greatest interest lies.
Carly, Mark Cuban, who owns the Dallas Mavericks at the NBA, wrote an article several years ago in which someone asked him, was he worried about the death of newspapers? And you know, again, we see it all the time, the news from the newspapers, the cutbacks, people losing jobs all over the place. Mark Cuban said that it was so valuable, the coverage was so valuable to them, he suggested that perhaps if the newspapers couldn't afford to pay the beat reporters anymore, maybe the leagues or the teams should pay the beat reporters because the advertising value of that 600 or 800 words every day was valuable. Is that a good or a bad thing?
I'd love to work for Mark Cuban. He gets great seats to all the games.
Nice plane, too, yes.
You know what? I've had the interesting experience in my career to have worked both internally for a team, the time I spent with the Tiger Cats, and also for a privately owned broadcaster. It was a small one, but it was still privately owned, NewCap Television in lovely Lloydminster. I've worked for CTV, which is a Bell Media-owned broadcaster, and now I've worked for CBC, which we know is federally funded. And each and every affiliate or, you know, station that I've been a part of, everything is run and functioned very differently. Mm. And there's always challenges with who you're working for and what their overall goal is. But the toughest, most challenging day I ever had was my first interview I ever did with the Hamilton Tiger Cats. And they sent me out to interview Quinton Porter, who is a very unique character, to say the least. He is very much an intellectual, and anybody who follows sports can tell you that most quarterbacks are next to brilliant.
Yes.
But I had to go out and do a feature with Quentin Porter, and I knew I was working for the team, but I was fresh out of journalism school, and I wanted to ask some tough questions. So I logged on to Ticast.ca, and I was reading some of the fan forums, and a lot of fans in Hamilton were critical because they didn't see Quentin Porter once in Hamilton during the offseason. Uh-huh. And I thought, I want to be loyal to this fan base. I want to ask a tough question. So sure enough, I'm sitting down with Quentin Porter, and you know, we've tackled all the rinky-dink small talk, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to hit him now. And I say, so Quentin, you know, you got a lot of fans here in Hamilton, but some of them are really confused and a little bit disappointed that they didn't see you anywhere during the off season. You were completing your MBA. And Quentin Porter just kind of looks at me and he shifts a little bit, and I can tell he's uncomfortable, and I've obviously struck a chord. So I say, why, you know, you're new to this team, why didn't you just dedicate your entire off season to football? And he gives me this answer, and I can tell he's really not impressed. And to be honest with you, I can't remember what he actually said or how he answered the question. All I can remember is that I could tell he was not happy with me.
Right.
Sure enough, I get back to the Ticats office. We publish the interview. It goes online. And who knocks on our door? It's the vice president of the Hamilton Ticats. And I sit down in his office, and he says, Carly, we're really happy with your work, but I have to tell you, you know, Quentin expressed a little bit of, he was uncomfortable with your interview. I'm like, oh my gosh, great, it's my first interview and already somebody's uncomfortable. He didn't like the fact that I challenged what he did in the off season.
Right.
And they told me, you know, you're working for the team. Let's make sure that we're sending the right message.
Right.
And I'm conflicted because I'm a new journalist, and I'm thinking, yeah, but the fans wanted to know that. Yeah. Like, suck it up, Quentin Porter. But that was the reality that was passed on to me, that you're working internally.
That's one of the interesting ironies of this whole thing. When you talk about conflict of interest and an undue influence on journalism, it's often presented as that large media companies are the problem.
Right.
Actually, I started my career at the small but mighty Digby Courier in Nova Scotia, circulation 1200, and there were four of us on staff. And I've kind of worked in all kinds of media organizations between then and now. The pressure there was far, far greater than anything I've experienced since then. One of the ironies is that, well, because when you're the small but mighty Digby Courier and you have 1,200 subscribers, and the mayor's office is literally two doors down from your office, there's all kinds of sensitive local political issues that you don't want to tread on to, and you know, and those organizations are living hand to mouth for the most part. You get into large organizations, the irony is you tend to be freer. You tend to be more insulated from those things. The revenue streams are more diverse. And the larger organizations that I've worked for tend to have a greater appreciation for the fact that at the end of the day, the only thing we have is our credibility.
Right.
The only thing we have is the trust of our audience. And so, yes, there are commercial interests and there are ownership interests and there are political issues that come up and things like that. But everybody has a basic fundamental understanding that the audience out there, the minute they stop trusting you, you're done. You might as well pack up and go home. And so what I have actually found is it's the large media organizations that tend to have a greater appreciation for that.
Bruce? Would that be your observation of the larger organizations?
You know, I tend to agree with Steve about the integrity and the quality of the men and women who work in these large organizations. But my point is that the coverage, you know, creates a monoculture of understanding that in effect distorts what is the lived experience of sport. Secondly, that's the first point I wanted to make. The second one is that within these contractual arrangements, most of which are contractual, I think it would reassure skeptics and critics like me if those contracts were made public to answer the, perhaps not with the dollar figures put in, but to show, to demonstrate, to ascertain, to reveal What, if any, constraints on journalists are contractually made in the contracts between the various entities involved in these agreements? Mm-hmm. The CBC, for sure, for example. I mean, in an earlier day, we knew that people like Bruce Dobigan were either not renewed or kicked off shows because of the influence of, you know, of teams and the league. There is still fear that that is the case. Why not make these contracts, particularly in the case of these incredible concentrations of power, publicly available to ascertain that there is no undue relationship in the way these sports are covered?
We've got about 15 minutes left till we go to the question period, and so now's the time to think of those clever questions to stump us out here. About 15 minutes. I want to sort of move this discussion. We're talking about how reporters do their jobs, and one of the things that we grew up with was we rarely, if ever, got into a person's personal life. If a person's marriage wasn't working well, if they were having some drinking problems, whatever it was, by and large, those people were considered to be off bounds, that you couldn't get into that unless it completely affected their work. One of the things that we've had in the last month, of course, is the revelation of the first openly gay team sport athlete coming into the public realm. That's their personal life. Will we start to change the rules when we're dealing with a gay athlete in this situation? And I'll give you an example, for instance. If two gay athletes on a team become involved with each other, is that something that's out of bounds, or is that something now that becomes part of the discussion and things that we have to report?
Well, my opinion?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, two sides to that. I think that over the past 10 years in particular, athletic and sports culture and celebrity culture have started to meld in a way that wasn't the case previously. Big sports stars are big stars, period, now. And so you tend to see them showing up the gossip pages and things like that, and what they paid for their house is news now and that kind of thing. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that that's a reflection of the fact that people do have a very deep appetite for knowledge about what's going on in these people's celebrity lifestyles. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the example that you just described there, I think it's really, really important the fact that Collins stepped forward himself.
Right.
I personally would never out an athlete. In the example that you brought together, if two athletes got together, unless they decided to step forward themselves and make that relationship public, I think that that should absolutely stay private.
Okay.
Like you said, if somebody has got a raging drug or drinking problem and it's obviously affecting their work on the field.
And they're not the mayor, yes.
Oh, yeah, for example. then you've got a more difficult ethical question. I would say once it starts to affect their ability to perform on the field, then you've probably got a legitimate area for journalistic inquiry. Other things like personal lives, I think, stay off limits until they decide to step forward themselves.
Well, let me ask Carly about it, because one of the big stories here a couple of weeks ago, or maybe 10 days ago, of course, was the famous vignette from the Toronto Maple Leaf game in which they were showing the crowd. And they were showing the wife of the goalie, Reimer's wife, and they were showing the actress, girlfriend of Dion Phaneuf, and interacting. Is that grist for the mill? Is that stuff we should be covering?
I have to tell you, when I walked into CBC and I spoke to my producer, and he told me that that was what we were running before we went into sports, I rolled my eyes and I said, you got to be kidding me. And he said, well, they want to talk about it. And I looked at my producer and I said, why? This was an unbelievable hockey game.
Right.
Can we start there?
Yeah.
And this is what I was talking about before, where we're going to that point now where the reaction, and you know, Steve has alluded to, you have to feed your audience. You got to keep your audience happy. That's who you're targeting always. How many people care about that? The problem is
a lot of people yes, cared about it. That was the problem.
A lot of people cared about it.
Yeah.
And my frustration is it goes back to this integrity factor. I don't want to be the person. I don't want to be TMZ. We have TMZ to do that. If somebody wants to see this, let's let them go elsewhere. But we're going to tell good stories. Let's talk about the story of this hockey game.
Right.
What ended up happening was is I really went to bat for myself because I didn't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to get there. I didn't want to go to that point. And I think that as a storyteller, you have to be willing to pick your battles and you have to be willing to stand up for what you think is right. And on that morning, I went to the senior producer. Mm. And I said, you know what? I don't want to be the one to talk about this. If you want to run it before we go into sports. And let Heather Hiscox read it. Right. Let the eye roll. Slow it down if you want to. Show it three times. I don't care.
Right.
But I don't want to be the one to talk about it.
Right.
And I really put my foot down and
said no.
But
when the CBC is doing that sort of thing, I guess it tells us the thin edge of the wedge.
Yeah, so that I think is the lesson that I learned on that particular day is there is a point where someone will listen to you and if you say no, and I think you just have to be willing to do that. You have to know when to draw a line in the sand. And I think if somebody like me doesn't do it, who else will? Because if I am then the sports reporter who's standing up there being the one to talk about this, then I think we have a bigger problem on our hands.
Bruce, if when you were an athlete, they decided to talk about your personal life, that, oh, I don't know, you collected stamps or something, whatever it was, they got into your personal life, would that have bothered you? And is it something that in this day and age should be grist for the mill?
You know, thinking about that, I'm reminded of the distinction that the late Scott Young on panels like this a generation ago used to make. The distinction between the public's interest in the personal life of athletes and coaches and so on, and their right to know things that were relevant to the performance, the outcome, the organization, the funding of the sport.
Right.
I like the answers that my colleagues on this panel have given, that in terms of personal information, it should only be revealed if the athlete or coach manager volunteers that and is happy with that. And also to minimize the amount of, quote, entertainment trivia that is generated in the course of these broadcasts.
I would like to add, too, though, that I think that actually you can do great, important journalism delving into people's personal lives. And one of the examples that immediately comes to mind, we did a story last year. Dan Robson, one of our writers, did a story with Clint Malarchuk and the little difficulties he's had in his life. If everybody remembers Clint Malarchuk, he had his jugular vein severed during a hockey game back in the 1980s. And he had a lot of personal problems with anxiety and with drugs, and culminated with a suicide attempt years after he retired. Now, obviously, that's an incredibly personal story, but we could only tell that story if Clint was willing to step forward and tell that story himself. Yeah, right. Once he was willing to take part, I think that was an enormously valuable story for us to tell. And it was a sports story, but it was also a story that went well beyond sports.
Yeah, I know I had the experience with Scott Oak, who's been a colleague of mine for a number of years, and I spent about a year and a half after his son died from a drug overdose, basically saying, whenever you want to talk, talk, but I'm not going to talk about this until you're ready. And he did finally say that, okay, he and his family were ready, and they cooperated, and the stories were fantastic stories.
Yeah.
They helped. But, yeah, it was him and his family saying, okay, now's the time, rather than me jumping in there. Let me get back. I just want to briefly go down the panel line here and ask this, because I raised the Mark Cuban thing, and you, Carly, you dodged it very ably there. But if that's all that's left, certainly on the print side, if that's all that's left to us as print journalists or that kind of a journalist, that we would have to pay the teams and the leagues to take us on the road with them and support the beat stuff, do we still do it? Or is that, at that point, are we not journalists anymore, that we have to just basically pack it in?
No, man. All I can say is I hope it doesn't get to that point. You know, I don't think that it's to that point yet. But I do think that, you know, there are interesting things happening. The Los Angeles Kings a few years ago, they were not happy with the coverage that they were getting from their local media. They reached out and they hired one of the beat reporters away from the newspaper and said, we want you to write for our website. Mm. And, you know, reading his stuff on the LA Kings website, it's pretty good stuff. It's you know, it does not read like press release. I don't know what his quid pro quo deal is with the LA Kings, but he's covering them like a reporter, and he is not universally fawning, I can tell you. And I think that's an interesting model for particularly for teams that feel like they can't get a fair shake from the big commercial media. in their market.
Because a lot of the LA papers were not sending guys on the road.
That's right.
There was no coverage when the Kings weren't doing well for a few years.
They couldn't even get their highlights on the evening newscast when they were one of the best teams in the league.
Right. Carly, where do we draw the line here?
For me, I really enjoyed working for a team. It was fantastic because I spent the most amount of time. I knew that team inside out. So when somebody showed up from a network and, you know, they were wondering why Jamal Johnson was walking with a little bit of a limp, I knew he'd been dealing with it for 3 weeks. And I knew exactly what it was. I knew when it started. So I really enjoyed working for a team. You have to understand, for me, I need a job. And I, like everybody else, I'm sure you all have bills to pay and I need to be employed. But I really enjoyed working for a team. But there are, you know, pushes and pulls, I think, with whichever employer you have. When I worked at CTV Edmonton, we had phenomenal access to the Edmonton Oilers. And it was similar, but I had plenty of other teams and responsibilities to cover. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my job was different. Yes, mm-hmm. I was close to this team, but I wasn't an expert on this team. Now I'm at, you know, a national network, mm-hmm. and what I do every day changes.
But where's that? Where's that line for you?
Can you
see us in our business going on the road with the team and being paid for by the team just so they can continue? The work would still appear in the newspaper, mm-hmm. but it would be financed by the.
I agree with Steve that I hope that it doesn't get to that point because I think there is so much value in good objective storytelling mm-hmm. that I would be concerned that would get lost along the way. And what purpose would that serve anyone?
But it's going to be on the audience. Thing I would add is that you're going to get the media you pay for.
And if that's what someone's willing to sponsor, and if that's where I get my job and I can pay my bills, maybe that's, you know, if you were to say to me, are you ever going to work for a team again one day? Mm-hmm. I would say, I don't know.
Right.
Because maybe that's what it will come to for someone like me. Right. You know, for someone like me who this is my profession, this is my career, it's very likely that that's what might happen. Maybe I'll get a call from... you know, whoever to go work for their team.
Bruce, how far is too far in terms of that relationship? If we don't want the coverage to disappear completely, we want to still have some people who are watching this and who can occasionally comment on it. Is there a point for you at which too far? A point at which is too far?
Well, I think it's gone too far when the media corporations ask, amateur Olympic or university teams and leagues to pay for coverage, which has been happening for many years. I think it's so that if, unless you can cover the cost of production, then we're not able to cover you. I think it's gone too far when media outlets ask that you provide them with all the information ahead of time. Which has been asked for years and years and years. I think it's already gone too far when the whatever it is 90-95% of the coverage deals with male sports in a society where in most sports women constitute half of the participants, if not the majority, where Canadian Olympic teams for the last 20 years, 25 years, have been roughly equal, male and female, and yet that situation is rarely seen in the sports that we have. So that would be a start.
Okay. We're coming up to around 7:30, and that's the point at which we'd like to get your feedback, because give us some guidance in terms of where your curiosity is taking you with our panel and ask stuff. We have the mic here. Is it just the one mic? We have the one mic in the middle here. If you want to come up, just identify yourself. You don't have to say who you work for. You can say who you're paid by if you want, but just come up and identify yourself and please fire away with questions, because I know somebody out there is curious. Yes.
I used to do some volunteer work with the Canadian Paralympic Committee, and then everyone's been talking about storytelling, and we always thought that Paralympians were the great human interest story of our time and could not get any level of interest. Is there, what code didn't we crack, do you think?
Well, I can speak for CBC. first and foremost. And I know that CBC's mantra is that we never want Canadians to meet an Olympic athlete, whether that's a Paralympian or an Olympian, on the podium for the first time. And I think that since CBC is making an effort to not only cover both, you know, the Pan and the Parapan games, it's almost as simple as having, I don't want to say the opportunity, but now we have a platform where we get to showcase these athletes for real, doing what they do. Not just the story leading up to it, not just the story afterwards, but I know that at CBC, there's been a conscious effort that we do this mantra all year round, not just when there's an Olympic year. So, you know, we've had story meetings where we're reaching out to, you know, the Canadian Olympic Committee, the Canadian Paralympic Committee. And when you have a mantra like that, I think that's maybe what sets the CBC apart a little bit, is that there is a commitment to, we want to know all of these athletes before, after, and during. And, you know, even if it's inviting them visibility-wise, we just had our fall launch, and there were several Paralympians there, and they were introduced. So I know that for us, it's been a visibility, it's an interaction, it's letting them come into our building and meet the public so that it's more personal. It's not just, you know, seeing them or hearing them or talking. It's also engaging them with the audience. And that's something that we found that's been really successful. When we've had the athletes present when we're promoting these events and promoting our coverage, just that communication factor, shaking someone's hand and being like, yes, I'm competing in this event. You can watch me. You can see me. So that's been something that's been effective for us. But as far as making that better, and what needs to be done, I think it's an ongoing process.
Well, let me get Steve, give us the private side view of this thing, and how does he crack that Rubik's Cube?
I think you might have just been a little bit ahead of your time, to be honest with you, because I think it might be changing.
Happens a lot.
Yeah. I think it might be changing. Go back 5-10 years ago, I think that there was a condescending attitude towards the Paralympics, like it was the fake Olympics. You know, oh, isn't it nice? They let the disabled people come and have their Olympics after the real Olympics. Mm-hmm. And by that point, everybody has gone home. That attitude, I get the sense that that attitude is changing a lot, and it was actually London that I think might,
Very much.
Look back in a few years and say London was the one that changed it.
Yeah.
Because the ticket sales for the Paralympics in London went as well, if not better, than the mm-hmm. main Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
There was an enormous amount of attention focused there, particularly within the UK. And they got at exactly what you're talking about, that these are incredible human interest stories. They're also incredible athletics stories. But in the past, I think, like I say, the Paralympics fell victim to that kind of condescending attitude that, oh yeah, they're all very nice. And frankly, you know, the organizers didn't always do the greatest job of articulating what those stories were. The stories tended to have a sameness to them, mm-hmm. that once you heard a couple of Paralympic stories, yes, they're all great stories about overcoming these incredible hurdles in their lives, and they're all kind of heartwarming stories about the value of sport, but how many of those can you hear before you feel like you've heard them all? You know what I mean? And I think that that's just a practical challenge. But like I said, I think that that's changing. I think, well, we just did a big shoot a few weeks ago, and one of the athletes that was out with us was Summer Mortimer, who's a great Paralympic swimmer for Canada. And she was, you know, bending my ear about the exact same thing. These are great. They're not just great human interest stories. They're great sports stories, and you need to get on them. And I think
that
you're
how much of that is cultural, though, too? I mean, you talk about London and a Western technological country where there's visibility. What we're going to see with the next series of Olympics is the Olympics going to places where
it's a
totally different perspective. I'm not even sure what the plans are for the Paralympic Games or the Paralympic Olympics when they go there, and whether they're going to get the same shot in those countries, because the culture might not be as accepting as London was.
As far as the audience is concerned, too, which obviously fuels a lot of this, even at CBC, we stayed in Trafalgar Square and broadcast live the first week of the Paralympic Games. And yes, we didn't stay there for 2 weeks like we did when the Olympics were on for the Paralympic Games. We were there for a week, but because of the incredible reaction, we were forced to react to that. Because there was so much support, because there was so much interest, CBC was forced to react to that. And it almost was like one fueled the other.
Yeah. Right.
And I think that we might just be getting to the point now where it will be not just 1 week, where it will be the full 2 weeks.
Right.
But I think it does have to start somewhere. And I completely agree with Steve that there has been a stigma and an attitude. And I learned my lesson when I went out and did an unbelievable story on Kieran Block, who is a sledge hockey player. And I said, why don't we do this more? But this year, during the Sledge Hockey Championships, I fought for that. And we had that on CBC every morning. But I think you need, and I'm not trying to put myself up on a pedestal, but I think you do need people to step up and say, we've got to get this on. We've got to get this on. And I guess I can't really answer your question that well of what it's going to take for there to be other people to say, hey, I've met some of these athletes. We got to get this on.
We've seen the first few breakthrough stars, like Chantal Petitclerc was a breakthrough star.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar Pistorius before anything really, really bad. Yeah, he was a breakthrough star,
yes.
But you know, a few of those breakthrough stars start to attract attention, and it builds over time. Mm-hmm. So, like I say,
thanks very much.
Thank you. Just a brief commercial message. They're great stories. So if you're talking about mm-hmm. storytelling, I'd encourage you to.
The other thing is too, and I have to tell you, because I have an email address and I work in a building where we're always looking for stories, you'd be surprised how much we don't hear from people.
Yeah.
You know, don't be afraid to, you know, to reach out, especially to your public broadcaster. Like, hey, my next door neighbor wakes up every morning and runs the Zamboni at the community rink, and that place wouldn't be there if it wasn't for him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great story. And you know what? I'm sure Peter Mansbridge would put that on the National. You know, you'd be surprised, though, how much we don't hear. So I would encourage, and I know one of my colleagues just started working on the Pan Am Games, and he's their new communications coordinator. You better believe we get emails every day. So yes, the stories are out there. Resources is something that Steve brought up, and is it acceptable that the resources aren't good enough? No, but unfortunately, that's part of the problem. Maybe it shouldn't be, but don't be afraid to reach out to people, and especially in this world we live in now where you can talk to Peter Mansbridge on Twitter, do it.
Question.
I've been urged to ask something. I'm Ian Urquhart. I used to work at both the Star and McLean's for many years. I've got to give you a preface for this question, so bear with me for a minute. When I was in management, we used to gnash our teeth over our failure to attract younger readers. And finally, one day I said, well, why don't we cover their sports, cover high school and college sports? And so we started doing more of that. Not as much as I would have liked, but we did start doing more of it, and especially in the high school level, build a good niche there for the Star. Now, of course, in the current environment, with cutbacks, that was the first thing to go. So you see almost no high school and sports coverage in our newspapers, and very little on TV. And it's such a sharp contrast to the U.S., because you go down to the U.S., and not just a big-time college sport that you see, college football and college basketball every year, but all sorts of other college sports are heavily covered down there. So why don't we do it up here? What are the institutional roadblocks in the way of that? And how can we blow them away and start giving? Oh, by the way, apropos of Bruce Kidd's point, it's a good way to start covering more women in sport because, of course, half of mm-hmm. high school and college sport is mm-hmm. female. Thank you.
Well, obviously, the United States, the NCAA, made conscious efforts to divide the money half and half so that produces. Bruce, you're at the institutions. You're the guys at the front of this thing. Why are we not hearing the great stories about athletes at the U of T?
I wish I knew. We get more NC2A coverage in the Canadian sports media than we do of the CIS on many days of the week. And why is that? Well, it's easier to take the feeds that the well-funded NCAA provides, and it's a lot harder to make the contacts and actually do the work to cover your own people. And that's been a Canadian tradition increasingly for a very long time. I don't know. I don't know. I always thought that the Star's excellent coverage of high school sport gave it circulation, gave it prominence, gave it its leadership in Toronto, and was very sad to see that decline. It contributes to the synergies of underdevelopment of high school sport in this region.
Bruce, there's, you know, it also harkens back to an age when you covered that as a newspaper or a local TV station as part of your citizenship. You know, that you as an organization were citizens of a community and you covered them for citizenship. You didn't necessarily even anticipate getting readers or viewers to it, but you just felt it was something that you should do or had to do as being part of the community. And I think, you know, with the disintegration of the newspaper chains, and I mean, across Canada now, a number of the newspapers, they've taken away publishers now. They've just got managing editors in Calgary and Edmonton, places like that. I mean, that sense of community and community service mm-hmm. seems to have been lost, and that's part of what you're talking about in terms of high school and college stuff in Canada.
I was a Title IX athlete. Sorry, I wouldn't have had my post-secondary school paid for if it wasn't for Title IX. I went down and played soccer. So, did I get letters from the University of Toronto and UBC to go play soccer there? I did, but I went to the States just because I got it paid for. And when I was down there, actually my first job was at an NBC affiliate in Baltimore. And I was blown away by their incredible high school football coverage and all of their high school sports for that matter. So I know that culture, I've worked in it, I've been a part of it. One of the two things I will say, it starts with money. I hate to say it, but Toyota, when I was down there, bought a feature called the highschoolplaybook.com. And I'm talking about, this is a it still exists. It's a coast-to-coast, it's an all-encompassing high school sports platform. And it's still thriving. And it made me realize, one, it's about money, because when you get Toyota's dollars behind something, it can do well. And second thing is, it starts locally. We were WBAL-TV, the NBC affiliate in Baltimore, and we would get calls from our region asking us for this material. And you'd be surprised how much easier it is to get your stuff shown on larger networks or regional networks when you've already got the content done and collected, because then they don't have to use their resources for it. And so I think it has to start locally, because then it can spread. You know, it's
well, one of the other things that happened in this country too, and I'll speak from self-interest here, as this next gentleman who's going to ask me a question knows this very well, is that CBC completely abandoned local sports.
Yeah.
Several times. You know, I don't know how many times people came to me with a sad face and said sports isn't part. Well, they used to say weather isn't part of the local shows anymore. But that was a huge blow mm-hmm. for across the country. And it was a huge blow because we weren't training journalists. I mean, I was one of the last guys to come out of that system, but Gord Miller, who's at TSN, that generation of people, that's where they learned. And I don't know where they're learning right now. Hey, I'm taking your time. Go ahead.
Good to see you too.
How are you, man?
Former CBC employee, and I worked for the evil empire known as Sun News Network. No longer do sports, but sports most of my life. Yeah. I want to speak to Charlie and Steve directly about
I'm Carly. She's Carly. The twin
Sorry.
Sister.
I knew I was going to
get that. Well, he doesn't work at CBC anymore.
Oh, there you go. I don't watch.
I'm the nice twin. That's how you can remember.
I will remember that. But specifically about the lack of coverage of local, high school, mm-hmm. amateur sport for both your networks. You both work for national organizations with local entities. Mm-hmm. Why can you not get back into the local markets on a bigger level and get the high school sports out there, get the amateur sports out there? You have tentacles out there. Why can't you use them?
Steve? You want to start, or should I?
Do you want to know how many times I go down to the camera room and ask for a camera, and I'm told that I don't have a cameraman available? Mm-hmm. And it's not acceptable. I agree with you. I can't tell you how many times I have pitched. You know, the best story I've done since I've been at CBC was about Rebecca Lee Bentham. Have you ever heard of her? She's blazing a trail on the LPGA. Absolutely. She's Canada's youngest pro golfer. And I had to book my camera 3 weeks in advance. 3 weeks in advance, because she was playing at the Manulife Classic in Waterloo. 3 weeks. And that's not acceptable, but to answer your question in the quickest way possible, it's a matter of resources. And it's a matter of dollars and cents. They have cut back and cut back and cut back. And when there's an opportunity, okay, do you send the camera to the Leafs game to get the pregame skate, or do you send a camera to Rebecca Lee Bentham in Waterloo? That's my reality. Steve, that's the best way I can.
Steve, your company has, I think, just signed.
Ted Reeves said many years ago that the Leafs haven't changed the way they practice in 40 years, and we cover and we cover every practice all the same.
Somebody might say something. You never know.
Yeah.
I was just going to say for Steve here, your company has just signed with the CIS, I
yes.
believe.
Thank you for saying it, so I don't have to.
Well, because it would be flackery from you. For me, it's just, right. For me, it's just an observation. Is this an attempt by you guys to try to rectify some of what we're hearing?
It is, but I wouldn't suggest for a second that it's altruism. You know what I mean? We're not going to broadcast CIS games because in any sort of, you know, altruistic community building exercise, we're going to broadcast CIS games because CIS games tend to be good football games, mm-hmm. and we think that we can get an audience there, which is great. We're also at the magazine. This is a bit of a scoop. We're going to do National High School Athletes of the Year, which is, you know, I wouldn't suggest for a second that that's a major undertaking, but we're doing what we can to respond to the fact that there are great athletes at the high school level across Canada. But I think it's a number of things. Carly mentioned resources. It's absolutely resources in terms of numbers of people and, you know, space and airtime and that sort of thing. But there's a lot of other things too. And the money thing is a big right. part of it. And it's not just money within media. It's the money that we've decided to invest in sports infrastructure in this country, which is dramatically different from the prioritization that we've seen south of the border. We have made a decision over the course of 50, 60 years in Canada, and for, I think, legitimate reasons, that we focus on the value of sports in terms of participation, in terms of, as opposed to, like, elite quality, you know what I mean? Where the sports system down in the United States tends to be more of a factory aimed at producing elite-level athletes and paving a road towards the pros. Up here, our systems tend to be more geared towards ensuring maximum participation. And there's great value in that, but it doesn't necessarily lead to something that gives you an elite product that you can package up and sell to a waiting audience, both in terms of viewers and in terms of advertisers.
So I was going to say, is that a Canadian thing?
That's why Andrew Wiggins is playing in the United States. That's why Tristan Thompson went to the United States to develop his basketball skills. That's why so many kids, if they can't make it into junior hockey, are looking to the NCAA. You know what I mean? There's a talent drain down to the States because there is money invested in that system, and certainly money on the media side. But it's, again, we get back to that chicken and the egg thing, and it is rooted in culture. For better or for worse, our audiences tend to be focused on the elite level. There is less of a sense. You don't have 5,000 people in small town Canada turning out on a Friday night to watch the high school football game. I kind of wish that we did, but in large swaths of the United States, that's exactly what you do. The football team, the basketball team, the track team is integrally woven into that local town's culture, and we don't see it in quite the same way. And as a result, it doesn't bubble its way up to media, and it doesn't bubble its way up to large advertiser interest and audience interest. Yep.
City TV, CBC, Mort Greenberg, all those guys were out there at every mm-hmm. track meet, every game, and there was stuff on every channel every day.
Yes.
Daily occurrence of something from a high school or an amateur meet on TV and all the dailies too.
I think.
And then all of a sudden it just stopped. And I don't think it was a financial thing. It was an organizational decision made by one network and it trickled down to the other networks and trickled down to all the other papers. Why can't the decision be made the other way? I'm not saying it has to be a massive influx of cash.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's some truth to what you're saying there, but I think that it is rooted in commercial reality. I think that, I mean, you talked about the community interest. A lot of the newspapers decided we're just going to cover high school and university sports, not because we're going to make a lot of money at it, but because this is part of our role reflecting the local community. I don't think the economics are there for local newspapers
anymore. I think
it's
not going unnoticed.
They just don't do that stuff.
Yeah, I don't think it's going unnoticed, though, either, because we just had a meeting last week, an ideas meeting, if you will. And there's a new project launching in the fall. And Malcolm Kelly, who's not here, but I'm sure you've all read him and know him well, he pitched an idea about high school. And I elaborated on it by going into my high school playbook experience down in Maryland and how unbelievably successful that was. And I don't know yet if it's going to be approved and something's going to come of it, but there are very many minds out there who are working with decision-making power who are aware of what we're talking about right now. It's just that they're asking the same question that you're asking. How do we get it to the point where it's marketable? How do we get it to the point where people are actually going to log online and read this and watch it? So it's not that it's going unnoticed. I just want to make sure that you know that too.
We have time for another question here.
Thanks. So far, obviously, we've been talking about, you know, big league, mass media, mass audience events. I'm wondering if there's any room for a kind of like a long tail aspect of sport journalism conversation. Is there any merit, or do you want to ruminate at all on the sports that are not, you know, NHL, NFL, NBA? Room for the quality journalism in the sports that we all participate in and enjoy, you know, bike racing and endurance sports. A journalism model for, you know, a journalism long tail model for that. We do know that there's a mass fragmented audience for those
soccer's
things.
The great example of that in Canada. Soccer's always been on the verge in Canada, right? And you know, it's been verging for 25 years.
Yeah, and I think we're making, actually it's worse than it, sorry to excuse my flackery here, but we are actually making pretty big investments in those kinds of sports. Cycling, we want to be the home of cycling. You know, we're broadcasting all the big races except the Tour de France this year, and then we get the Tour de France next year. And you know, we're very hopeful that there's a lot of opportunity there. We've made a major investment in curling this year, which isn't exactly a fringe sport in Canada, but it hasn't had traditionally the same level of media support behind it. We've got a big investment in cricket. We're Canada's leaders in terms of soccer broadcasts. So I think that there is a commercial opportunity there, but you have to be strategic in how you pick them. That's for sure. And you know, because we are a commercial enterprise. We need to make money at it. And we think that there's a big opportunity there. We think that there is a big but fragmented audience, like you described it. And I guess check back in a few years, see how it worked out. But we're pretty optimistic.
Bruce, I want to get back to the point that Steve just raised, the idea of Canada, our perspective is more about widespread participation at a basic level as opposed to an elite athlete factory. Is that your observation as well?
No, I shook my head at that. I agreed with the first part of the Canada-U.S. comparison, but not the second. Participation rates are sinking like a stone in Canada. Public bodies, schools, municipalities are cutting back on the opportunities they provide, and they've been doing that for decades now. The class base of children and youth who engage in amateur and community sport is going higher and higher, and that's true for even sports like hockey. We are failing our children and youth in not providing them with opportunities, and as a result, fewer and fewer Canadian children and youth are engaged in sport. The Healthy Active Kids annual report card came out the other day, and it reinforced that point. There are a number of factors to explain it. It's not a single factor. People spend a lot of time wondering why it's happening. It's not only happening in Canada; it's happening, you know, all over the world. Canada is very much like Australia. It's happening in Australia too. It's a complex challenge. So it would be great if the media, in the public interest, shared the worrying about these questions and contributed to that debate. The Toronto Star did a terrific series in this last winter about the cost of participation in hockey and the consequence of the high cost of participation on participation in that sport across the GTA. It's a wonderful two-part series, but I didn't see any other media outlet pick that up, and I think there should be more contributions of that kind. You know, Steve keeps on talking about the economic imperative of, you know, the sport media corporations, but his company is given a license in the public interest. And we should expect that in addition to their right to survive economically, they act in some ways in the public interest. And perhaps, as an earlier generation did, we should be taking his corporation and the CBC to the CRTC and demanding that if their license is going to be renewed, that they do certain things as a condition of that license, like providing 50% of coverage of women's sport, for example, like showing a significant proportion of the sports that are played at a, you know, in five or more provinces on their coverage, or their license would not be renewed.
We've got about 5 minutes left here.
Okay, sorry.
One more question. Okay, let's get one more question if we can. Okay.
Hi, my name is Paul Deegan. There's been a lot of coverage in the last couple of years about concussions in professional sports, mm-hmm. especially here in Canada and the NHL. Do you think sports journalists have done enough to promote, to you know, really advance discussion in that and to actually promote player safety?
I do. To be honest with you, I think that that story has been really well covered. I mean, is it covered enough? I mean, you could always argue that as long as people are still getting concussions, we're not saying enough about it. As long as people are suffering from, you know, the devastating effects of post-concussion syndrome, we're not doing enough. Again, I actually wrote one of the first stories in Canada about post-concussion syndrome, and how do you evaluate when you've done enough? I think that the players are more aware than they ever have been before. I think the leagues are more aware than they have ever have been before. And actually, a lot of the media coverage, particularly the New York Times, did a lot of great work on this back 4 or 5 years ago. It forced a lot of change. The NFL spent 10 years telling everybody there was no concussion problem, that their players weren't suffering very many concussions, and those who were suffering concussions had no long-term after effects. It was a panel of doctors that worked for the league that just lied and lied and lied and lied, and the media put those lies on the table and forced a 180-degree reversal on the part of the NFL. You know, I'm hopeful that there will continue to be changes, both in terms of rules and equipment and that sort of thing, that will continue to improve that situation. I think Derek Bugard's family has just launched a wrongful death suit against the NHL, which is going to put a lot of interesting questions in front of the league, whether or not, you know, their continued acceptance of fighting in the game requires people to take undue risks with their health and safety, whether or not there's adequate follow-up care for people suffering concussions, whether or not there's adequate care for, you know, people who get addicted to pain meds. All those things are going to get decided, and I don't think that that story is nearly done, but I would certainly say that the media hasn't been negligent in burying it by any means.
I would think in an era of everybody doing the same kind of story and et cetera, this is one of the few shining star stories that's out mm-hmm. there, where people have taken enterprise journalism and you know, as opposed to maybe some of what Bruce is saying, taking on the NFL, taking on the NHL, and doing stuff in an impertinent way to them that shows the real true spirit of journalism, mm-hmm. which is that we don't care if you're going to give us a hard time. This is an important story. So there's not a ton of these kind of stories, but I think this is one of the good ones, one of the best ones. And as you say, the leagues are reacting. You're seeing the change in what's going on.
And they continue to monitor. I mean, they brought in the concussion protocols, but reporters are still monitoring the compliance with those protocols as well. You see guys take huge hits, and all the reporters know that guy's supposed to leave the bench now and go back. And if he stays on the bench, there's a story about it.
Yeah. The quiet room has become sort of a little bit of a Twitter joke, but there's a seriousness mm-hmm. behind it.
Yeah. You're shaming.
Go to the quiet room.
Yeah.
I can tell you when I've gone to arenas in the NHL, I've specifically looked for said quiet room. So, yes, there is a conscious awareness, and there's a responsibility to find those rooms and to let people know, hey, it's here, I know it's here. You know, there's a buzz. You want to be the one to find it and to share that with everyone. But I also think my point on this would be, there are a few times when stories that are sports stories transcend into news stories as well. And I certainly have seen, especially with the issue and the coverage of concussions and the Derek Bugard lawsuit, we had his lawyer on CBC for about a 5 or maybe even 7-8 minute interview talking about it specifically. Every once in a while, a sports story is big enough to transcend that boundary into a news story, and I certainly think that very much so, the concussion story, if you will, has done that repeatedly, and I think will continue to, especially in light of the fact this story that surfaced with Don Fear and the Players Association working on getting fighting eliminated from the NHL. That was a French article that was translated. I think it was Adam Proto sent that out. So I don't think we've seen the end of it. And I think as long as it continues to be as big as it is, it's going to continue to transcend that boundary, where it won't just be a sports story. It'll be the top news story of the day.
Well, I'm looking at the clock. We've reached 8 o'clock. Take this opportunity to thank our panelists. Or I don't know, are you going to do that, Bob? I was going to say on behalf of myself and how much I've enjoyed this, Steve Mach, Carly Agro, and of course Bruce Kidd, thank you very much for your participation. I didn't read the instructions, sorry.
It's all right, there aren't any. And thank you, Bruce, for coming here and also for animating such a really interesting discussion. And I must commend all of you for your candor, and I hope two of you aren't in big trouble tomorrow, but we'll
I'll
be there. We'll be behind you 1,000%,
okay.
As somebody once said. I think as well, I want to underline the fact that sponsorship is not an inhibition to good, open, frank, and journalistic discussion, which gets me to thank Paul Deegan, who's here tonight, and BMO Financial Group for a terrific support throughout this past season of these J-Talks. So thank you, Paul. And he doesn't tell me what to say. And with that, why don't you join us for some refreshments?
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Para que la gente me siga oyendo.